Monday afternoon, 28th May 1973. This morning, we considered this question of percept and concept. The percept, remember, is the living experience in the now. And the concept tends to diminish the experiencing of the percept in the now, because the concept names the percept and then dismisses it by just uttering the name. Oh, that's a rose, and that's finished. One doesn't fully experience the rose in the now. And thereby, communion is not realized. Now, this does not mean that the concept is always the villain of the piece. In fact, the concept is not the villain of the piece. The concept, the thought, and it is a thing of memory, remember, is an indispensable necessity in our moment-to-moment living process. Because it is the concept that structures the percept and associated percepts. If that structuring doesn't take place, our percepts would everlastingly be at the newborn infant stage. The newborn infant just stares fixedly at what it is looking at. And it remains in that staring state with no possibility of the growth of understanding of relationships or anything at all. But the recognition of the percept, which is due to the fact that a concept is there, that produces the recognition. This is mum, that is food, and so forth, is responsible for growth, understanding, ordering the process of life, the structuring of the events of life. So remember that the concept is extremely important as far as not only as far as ordinary daily living is concerned, but also where pure mental activity is concerned, intellectual activity as such, which is indispensable for us in every sense, not only the technological in the technological field, but also in the psychological, the philosophical, the metaphysical, every such field. Mathematics and science couldn't possibly exist and continue to grow and produce deeper knowledge of the nature of things if not for the fact that we have this extraordinary ability to play with concepts. This playing with concepts is our mode of investigation in the mental world itself, the intellectual world itself. That we must clearly bear in mind. Now, come back to this point about the release of this sensitivity from within, which does not utilize any naming process. As I said this morning, it knows as if by touch, not by sight. Now that knowing, in its fullness, is a non-analytical knowing. There is no analysis involved in that. It is the intellect which performs, which is the tool for carrying out the analytic synthetic activity. Because the intellect does both. It analyzes as well as puts the things together. And that's how it structures our experience. This sensitivity is par excellence a whole absorbing, a whole seeing faculty. And the two together, when they function unhindered, when the intellect, the analytic synthetic activity of the intellect does not intrude upon the immediate percept, then the state of communion comes into being full-fledged. And of course, meditation in the real sense is this sort of thing. Now, the intellectual external activity is something which functions very largely, almost entirely in many instances, within the sphere of the known. It is only when we obtain what we call flashes of insight or genius penetrates that something from the unknown, which belongs to a sensitivity beyond intellectual activity, comes within the purview of intellect. When a Newton gets the idea of gravitation, when an Einstein gets his ideas, or a Dirac or Heisenberg or whoever it is gets his ideas, these great inspirations, they emerge out of a realm which is beyond the ordinary analytic synthetic activity of intellect. It is, again, we may say, a sensitive region. There is a stirring of this feeling power of the mind. And this feeling, remember, is not just to be equated with mere sensation. Mere sensation is the mechanics of the event in which that which is outside the psychophysical organism makes its impress upon the psychophysical organism. The sensation part is the mere mechanics of it. The feeling part is this sensitive taking in, the absorbing part of it, which is from our living being. You get it? All right. Now, where meditation is concerned, as the feeling part operates more and more freely, without being inhibited by the intellectual part, which by and large is the realm of concepts, you will find that our concepts undergo change in accordance with this something which the feeling part conveys to us. The feeling part conveys, well, what the feeling part conveys is not named. There is no logical intellectual structure to it, no thought structure attached to it, no verbal process going on. But its influence upon the intellectual part enables the intellect to release specific thought forms and verbal expressions. Without this activity of the intellect, whatsoever the feeling part releases in our being would be of no use to us at all. It would just slip past us. We couldn't utilize it. Utilization needs a technique, a means, an instrument, a tool. And the intellect is the tool. Do we not find, with the passage of the years, with growing experience, as we call it, the same thing becomes richer and richer in our minds? We can talk about it, we can write about it far more clearly, lucidly. We can communicate it to another without difficulty, which we had in the earlier stages. You see, I'm trying to make all of us aware of the nature of this functioning of the mind and the extraordinary richness. Well, it's just immeasurable of what we so lightly and easily say, oh, that's the mind. We don't know what we are talking about. But meditation enables us to live, it enables our minds to live more and more fully and completely. Now, the concepts change. Let the concepts change. Don't think of them in terms of, oh, but this is real, this cannot be the case, or this, of course, it must be so. These are the commonest mistakes we make. Oh, it must be so, or it cannot be so. We say these things outright, without sufficient investigation, because there is all the conditioning that lies behind our concepts. Our concepts express not merely what we call our knowledge of the thing, but all our limitations of knowledge of the thing, the conditioning, the binding influences. Because in the forming of our concepts, we have acceptance and rejection. We have moral judgments. This is good, this is bad, and so forth. And if you look carefully into all this, you will find that it is the result of innumerable little factors and some large factors which have conditioned the mind and therefore produced a conditioned concept. Now, our definitions of the virtues are a very good example of that. We all know what is considered virtue in England, perhaps is not considered virtue in Timbuktu, and vice versa. Isn't that so? It is right to do this in Russia, and quite wrong to do it in America. The thing, the procedure, the action is the same. Well, how can this person say, oh, this is absolutely the right thing to do, and that person say, oh, it's absolutely the wrong thing to do, and both be correct? This is because our concepts, the conceptual forms in which we present morality, virtue, and so forth, these conceptual forms are conditioned forms, very powerfully conditioned, by not one, two, three forces, but literally by innumerable forces at play. And amongst those forces at play, perhaps the most powerful are our particular psychical reactions to our little daily experiences. Our daily experiences are always either painful or pleasant, and sometimes they are neither one nor the other. They are neutral. But in practically all cases, in association with the pleasant, there arises psychologically, I like. And with the unpleasant, I dislike. And the unfortunate conditioning which takes place is that we associate the idea of the good with what I like, and the idea of the bad or evil with what I dislike. Hence the continuous conflict. Now, a point to remember, and a very important point, is that we all react differently. Not entirely differently, obviously. It would be rather astounding to come across a man who puts his hand into the fire and says, "Oh, I like this, this is marvelous, this is excellent." Have you come across such a man? No, nor have I. You see, but I mean, apart from such extreme cases, in all our ordinary life, there are these shades of like and dislike, therefore of good and bad. And all these things, depending upon the way we ourselves are individually constructed, are different from everybody else. All these, in any one person, are different from the same things in any other person. The differences arise. But the important point to bear in mind is that our concepts are conditioned concepts, and the conditioning has its roots in the physical body itself. I'm dissociating it from the psyche, because the psyche produces the psychological counterpart of pure pleasure-pain. And the pure pleasure-pain mechanism, as we have seen again and again on past occasions, is the indispensable mechanism for the well-being and preservation of the physical body. If that mechanism went wrong, we are in danger of doing something or other which would, well, the body would just perish under those circumstances. It wouldn't survive. The survival of the body and its survival in a state of well-being depends upon the clear functioning, the right functioning for your own body of your own pleasure-pain mechanism. And the rest emerges out of that. This pleasure-pain mechanism of the body, no one can get rid of, no one should try to get rid of. Let it be as sensitive as possible, as perfect as possible. But what we can transcend is the psychological reaction in terms of I like, I dislike, this is good, this is bad. These are our mistakes. So now, what we call virtues are the things we believe are good, which we would like, or which we would like to like. Shall I put it that way? Now, when does the situation of I would like to like this emerge? When my egoism and vanity play their part. I would like to be considered a good man, a virtuous man. See, that sort of thing comes into play. It feeds my vanity and my egoism. So now, this virtue which I like, conditioned in this way by me, is it virtue in me then anymore? Because its virtuousness as a person other than myself might see it, is bedeviled by the play of my vanity and egoism. Is it not? You see how subtle the whole process is. Meditation reveals all this to oneself. Reveals it in depth. And the specific meditation one may go through has as its total background constant mindfulness. The 24-hour business. The one helps the other. Otherwise, I'm sure a good many of you, if not every one of you, has experienced this. You meditate, just as when you go to church, you're full of devotion and prayer and this and that, you're uplifted, you're exalted. And after the meditation is over, and the whole world seems fine and lovely and beautiful, and yourself almost growing wings, and then within the next hour something happens, and flop, down you descend into violence, greed, inconsiderateness, all sorts of mistakes, and you wonder, heavens, I thought I had made progress, what's the matter with me? Why? Because the mindfulness was absent. And I think I said yesterday, the mindfulness must not be an on guard attitude. That's quite wrong. Because that perpetuates conflict. That way you're in everlasting war. Not being on guard. But ready to observe and take in every aspect of that observation. Don't forget, the body can be slain. The psyche can be hurt, cannot be slain. Why be on guard? Your psyche lives as long as there is the living organism. It's a psychophysical organism. But the psychical part, which is the part that cannot be killed, the body can be killed. Both body and psyche can be hurt or pleased. So be fearless about this observation. There is no need to be afraid of seeing your own soul. This is what happens with all of us. We are afraid of the truth. We dislike the truth actually. That is to say, unconsciously we dislike the truth, whereas consciously we assert to ourselves, oh, I love the truth, do I? How many friends have you lost by telling them the truth? What have you yourself felt when somebody told you the truth about yourself? The immediate reaction inside, oh, he's quite wrong. He's a stupid. He's absurd. He's just jealous, etc., etc. I remember once a very distinguished man. He was a remarkable man. He was not distinguished in the sense of being a public figure. He was a penetrating psychologist, a Romanian, in the 1930s. I used to go to meetings where he held forth. The early 1930s, before 1932. And one day he turned round to all those present and said, all this that you are trying to do is ineffectual. Here is this man, he said, pointing to me, who you cannot upset. You can't upset his amiability, which is his great drawback. I had it from the horse's mouth. But being very amiable, you see, my psyche was able just to dismiss it like that. I was the loser thereby. I didn't realize what a wonderful opportunity for self-knowledge was lost by me there, by just dismissing that. Amiability was a virtue. But with amiability, there are associated several other things which are not quite so virtuous. You work it out yourselves. Years later, I really saw into it. Then that which is represented by amiability gets purified. So now, in the practice and the meditation upon the moralities, the virtues and so forth, everything grows. The virtue itself, the concept itself undergoes change. The sensitivity, the feeling sensitivity inside undergoes change and grows. And new formulations of that virtue, deeper understanding of that virtue comes into being. And this is spiritual growth. Because a virtue is mind power, just as a vice is also a mind power. It's a real energy which works and shapes your life. Now, with the growth of sensitivity from within, and with the growth of clear intellectual perception also, one sees and quite understands and develops the technique to fulfill it, that you cannot reject the defined vice, you cannot grab, pursue and acquire the defined virtue. We define our virtues, don't we? And we define them almost entirely in terms of what sort of actions or behavior presents a pattern to which we apply the name of this virtue. That is kindness. Because a person behaved like this. That is cruelty because a person behaved like that. That pattern of action, behavior, etc., receives the name of the virtue or the vice. Now, we cannot reject a vice like that arbitrarily. We cannot grasp at a virtue. With the growth of the understanding from within, as well as the power of, with the growth of the power of observation of the without, this defined virtue loses its definition, this defined vice loses its definition, because they are both becoming integrated in a process of purification. It's a strange thing to say. Virtue becomes purified, just as vice becomes purified. There comes the point when this mind power is an untrammeled, absolutely pure mind power as such. No fault in it. Then that is virtue in the full sense of the term. You see what the moralities imply. The stark, simple form in which these have been talked of by the great teachers hold within themselves an immensity and a richness which is incredible. Thou shalt not kill, said Moses. And the Buddha said that the bhikkhu abstains from taking life. The Hindus go to the put it in this form, the abstention from all harming. The abstention from all harming. Now when you work it out, and enter into it in depth, you see how it just means the totality of one's living process is like that. And you will also find that when you come to that sort of a condition, all the other virtues, as we say, have lost their otherness and have become the one thing which is virtue. The names we give are due to the fact that we are unwhole. We are unholy, and unclean and unholy mess, most of us, you see. And because of that, we describe this little bit of dirt as this vice, and that little bit of dirt in the psyche as that vice, and we give it different names. And similarly with the virtues. It's all fragmented. But when we really see, really understand, and have really grown, then the fragmentation, and the consequent dis-ease, the discord, the suffering, has gone. And we are living human beings. Living totally, living fully, living zestfully. How different from the good life as defined by the world. As defined and practiced, it's so utterly destructive, stupid, tragic. You know, they say in India, to the devas, we'll roughly use the word angels, all the merrymaking and songs of the earth are like a dirge and a wailing and a screaming in sorrow. That is what they call it. How true it is. How difficult it is to relinquish that which hurts, that which is evil. We cling to our own suffering and sorrow. And we are constantly in this state of conflict in the dualistic realm of this ambivalence of virtue-vice. Now let us see the other aspect, the further aspect of this. If we can become, we can grow into freedom out of this ambivalence, what happens to what we call meditation? Does it not become our natural state? Because if we are free from this ambivalence, the creative activity of this pure mind power, which we may name virtue, keeps us constantly in the state of communion. We are truly integral part and parcel of the totality. It's the state of communion. It's the state of freedom. It's the state of bliss. If we grasp this, really understand it, we will see the full significance of Sri Krishna's statement to Arjuna, on whatsoever path a man approaches me, on that path do I meet him. For the path which men take on every side is mine. You see how deeply, profoundly true scriptural teaching is. Recall what I said the other day. The holy ones understood the psyche of man inside out completely. not only the psyche of the millions who are in bits and pieces, who are ill at ease, diseased in mind, but they also knew all about the psyche which was perfected, which was utterly pure, transparent. That is why the teachings they gave were the embodiment of truth. It is only in the light of transcendence that the whole truth of that which is here in the realm of the finite and the mortal, the struggling, can be understood. We can see only partly, as through a colored glass or in a distorting image. In a distorting mirror. But when the mind has become whole, perfect in that way, then whatever is seen wholly, truly. Now, when we try to practice meditation on those moralities, harmlessness, truthfulness, non-covetousness, continence, kindliness, equanimity, steadiness of mind in gain and loss, and so forth. You see, all these aspects, we think of them as separate virtues, don't we? Well, naturally, we think of them as separate things. It is convenient to have these separate names, but we can take any one of those things, and if it comes to full fruition, everything else also has come to full fruition. You see, take the body, for instance. Supposing a part of the body, say the liver, is in trouble. Now, it is not merely the liver that will be in trouble. The bloodstream spreads that trouble right through the body, doesn't it? It's carried right through. So everything is in trouble. If the liver becomes wholly perfect, it can do so only because everything else has also become completely healthy. You see, the body is a wonderful book of life from which to learn truth. If we know how to use, how to read this book. But the point I wish to emphasize is the approach in terms of wholeness, the approach in terms of the elasticity of the mind, this infinite resilience of the mind, so that we ourselves do not obstruct the process of becoming clear seeing, to realize clarity of mind. Perfect clarity of mind means an enlightened being. And the meaning of clarity of mind is so immense, it is that immensity that I've been trying to suggest today. Now, I've talked rather more than I wanted to talk, that is to say, taken up more time. Now let us apply this to a little bit of meditation, shall we?